Morning, everyone. Hope you slept well. I certainly did. Hard up for the day yesterday. A couple of things before we start. I was just thinking this morning of... remember yesterday we talked about how you divide up the book of Leviticus, and I suggested, like, in my book I said 18 is probably a nice balance between moving through the text but being comprehensive. Not everybody wants to do that, so I give him other options as well. But a former student at college decided he would try that in his church. Said, I'll do all 18, I'll see where it goes. And when he came to me, he works at a Chinese church in Sydney, and he came to me and said, when I suggested that we do this, the elders in the church were particularly happy with the idea. They kind of assented, let him do it anyway. And one of them came up to him, an old Chinese gentleman came up to him afterwards, after he finished preaching Leviticus 1, and said, oh, we thought this series was going to be really dry and heavy. But it was like juicy watermelon. That's it, isn't it? Leviticus. Surprisingly juicy. Surprisingly life-giving. And I hope we can continue to explore some of that today. Some of you have already accused me of dropping propaganda around the seats. And of course, you're exactly right. I just don't have to carry him back to Sydney, that's all. But kind of some brief information on what SMBC does. Lots of you will be familiar with the college anyway. Some of you studied there. I know people who did. There's QR codes you can scan to find information. The only thing I'm going to say is that there are lots of options for professional development. So lots of you have done training already or finished while in college a long time ago. But some of you I know are thinking, oh, I'd like to do something else. I'd like to sharpen either a skill or knowledge. There are lots of good options that you can do either by intensive, fly over Sydney for a week, or you can do it online. You can remain where you are and join in a class that's working through a biblical book, for example, or thinking about, we just did an intensive last week, thinking about evangelistic preaching. Sam Chan taking people through that topic. And so there's lots of options. So you can continue to think, continue to develop, maybe join with others in doing some of that. And there are lots of other good colleges too, but SMBC is a good college. And so I'll leave those with you on the seats. You can have a look at those or ask me questions. If you like. What I want to think about a little bit this morning is to think about theological concepts and themes. Every book you go to in the Bible, there's lots of themes, lots of ideas, and unsurprisingly, Leviticus has lots of themes and concepts, things that we're going to have to grapple with ourselves as the preacher, but also then help our congregations grapple with those. And sometimes themes are really easier, not really easy, but straightforward because people are already familiar with them. Leviticus will bring a whole lot of themes that are really unfamiliar, or perhaps surprisingly unfamiliar. And there's lots of them as you look through. I've given you in your handout there, you can see there's kind of a word maze or word map of different ones. Lots of big ticket items. You could already list these off, I'm sure, like temple, tabernacle, sacrifice, atonement, sin, impurity, holiness, priesthood. They're the ones you kind of already know before coming this weekend or this week. But there's a whole lot more things that begin to emerge as you kind of spend time in the book, like food. How many of you have a theology of food? And if you don't, why not? Like you eat at least three times a day, I assume. Do you have a theology of food? Leviticus will push you to consider what your theology of food is. You think that's actually quite pertinent in the world we live in. There are social justice. Lots in here about that. How do we engage with those issues? What does God think about issues of justice and mercy and kindness in the world? What does that look like? Leviticus will make you think about that. Stuff about gender. There are sexual ethics. Not that the two are the same, but they're related. Leviticus has lots to do with that. Foundational. I mentioned Leviticus 18:20 yesterday. Foundational text for kind of biblical understanding of these things. Lots in there about land. What is a theology of land? And again, surprising things in Leviticus where land actually acts as a character like it does so often in the Old Testament. The land itself has an agency. The land will vomit out people who defile the land by their sinful actions. That's an interesting dynamic to explore and kind of connects into other things. Lots of stuff in here about theological anthropology. What does it mean to be human in this world? Leviticus will have a whole lot to say on that. So there's all the big ticket items, holiness and temple and sacrifice, but there's a whole lot of other stuff that's in here as well that I suggest is really valuable for exploring as a church. and we'll tap into lots of other things through the canon. And yet, as you kind of come to that, to the kind of feast of themes and ideas and kind of things to grapple with, a number of problems arise. In your handout, I put two, but I thought of another one this morning. Three problems, I think, that immediately surface as we kind of see all these kind of themes, the potential that's here. The first one, we talked a bit about this yesterday, is just unfamiliarity. There are themes here that people are just not familiar with. Ritual impurity. How many people in your church know what that is? They don't know what it is. How are they going to read Leviticus? How are they actually going to read the rest of the canon? Because that theme keeps on bubbling up all over the place, all the way through to the end of Revelation, it bubbles up. So we're actually going to look at a bit more about that this morning, so I'm not going to go on about that. But unfamiliarity for you, for your people, that's a key issue. Another one is just wrong definitions, or maybe incomplete definitions, or kind of key terms and ideas. So if I was to say, there's an idea, concept, theme in Leviticus, I think that's actually pretty crucial to Leviticus. How do we define that? Maybe also be brave, but what would you say? What would be some key things to put on the board? If we're going to say sacrifice is
something you give up.
Yeah, something you give up. Yeah, well done. Yeah, but something you give up or give.
An offering to God for a particular purpose.
Yeah, to God. What kind of purpose would you probably say?
Oh, it could be for sin.
Yeah, for sin. Or something given to God for sin.
Guilt.
Yeah, or guilt. Yep. What's it meant to do?
To atone.
Yes. Yeah. So give to God for sin, guilt.
Substitute.
For atone. What's the end result to atone by substitution so that the person forgiven? Yeah. So I'm more about keep nuancing that, but I think that's probably a fair pop summary, isn't it, of sacrifice. Something like that. That would be our kind of running definition, perhaps. Sacrifice, something given to God, usually an animal, his blood is shed, maybe we'd add that in as well. To God for sin or guilt to atone by substitution for forgiveness. Something loosely related to that. The problem is, if that's your running definition of sacrifice, it just comes unstuck when you turn to Leviticus. It doesn't work in lots of ways. Because sacrifices are not just offered for sin or guilt, but you offer sacrifices for purifying ritual impurity. Nor is a sacrifice always just to fix something. Whether you're trying to fix sin or fix impurity, sacrifices are offered for lots of other reasons too. You're not actually trying to fix anything. You can have the shedding of blood as part of sacrifice, but without achieving atonement or forgiveness. So think Leviticus 3, the fellowship offering. Lots of blood, it's an animal sacrifice. The end result is not forgiveness or atonement because there's no problem of sin being addressed. Leviticus 3. Or you can have atonement, sacrifice that produces atonement for sin that doesn't involve any shedding of blood at all. In Leviticus 5, you can bring a handful of flour, and yet the person goes away forgiven. So you think, our concept of sacrifice is going to have to expand to actually encompass the data that's here. And that's hard. I've had pastors in class before, in kind of Leviticus exegesis classes, who about 3 or 4 weeks in, sometimes get really annoyed. Sometimes with me, sometimes just annoyed in general, because these concepts that they've just been running with for years suddenly don't work anymore. I'm trying to say it's not my fault. Don't blame me, don't shoot the messenger. It's just we're exploring the Bible, and it's pushing your definitions to try and be a little bit more nuanced, a little bit more faithful to what the text is actually saying. Which pays dividends when you begin to read the rest of the Bible. So Leviticus can be a really helpful instructor in this. So here's sacrifice. We can put up atonement. We can put up sin, you can put up impurity, and do the same sort of thing. And it's going to push and expand into all of those different things. So I think that's just another issue that we're going to have to deal with in preaching Leviticus. It's unfamiliar, which doesn't help, but sometimes the definitions that people have, maybe that you have, but certainly your people will have, are either just incomplete and sometimes wrong. And so there might be a bit of kind of deconstruction and reconstruction in order to be able to hear the text well. And so again, think of how are you going to do that? Sure, the sermon can do that, but are there other ways that you can do that within a series? So unfamiliarity, wrong definitions or incomplete definitions. A third one that I thought of this morning is just density. It'd be so nice if Leviticus just had one major theme in each chapter. Because that just makes the series really easy. Here's chapter 1 and we're thinking about sacrifice. And then we're on to chapter 2, let's think about atonement. And chapter 3, we're thinking about tabernacle. That'd be great, wouldn't it? But it's not like that. And I think about the passage we looked at yesterday, Leviticus 1. How many themes in Leviticus appeared there? What appeared?
Atonement.
Worship. Yeah, so different social economic status, kind of social justice, maybe.
Participation.
Inclusivity. The big one, sacrifice. Priests and the role of priests. The tabernacle, it's all conducted at the tabernacle. Kind of implicitly ritual purity, which you need to be able to perform a sacrifice. Think, hold on a second. There may be some of you preach 4-hour sermons. And you can accommodate all of that within one sermon, but I think for most of us, that's not us. We don't preach for 4 hours. How do you help people grapple with Leviticus 1 when you've just got that density of topics, all of which are unfamiliar? It's a real challenge. And so here is, again, if you need it, a hint that kind of forward planning when you're considering a series is really helpful. But some of you are naturally forward planners, others of you hate forward planning. But I think if you don't do that with a book like Leviticus, you're going to end up in trouble. Because you've got to decide, okay, how many sermons am I going to do? What passages am I going to do in those sermons? And then what are the big themes? And when is it best suited to cover those themes? And so you might just do one each week along with a passage that really kind of taps into that idea. So you've got to think ahead. And so either reading the book yourself, you can identify themes, you can look up the introduction sections in commentaries, they often list, here's all the theological themes in this book. And so you can make a list, prioritize the ones you want to do, and think about which week you might want to do them in. So at least you're moving through and you're not just kind of dumping them all on one option, or sorry, in one sermon. So different ways I think you can do some of that work. So like I said, I think you can plan your passages and then kind of pick the theme that's going to resonate with a particular passage. Because you don't want to kind of go too early. You kind of think, oh, we're going to do atonement this week. It's a little bit tricky, but it kind of fits and we can work it on. And then kind of 5 weeks later, you think, oh, wait a minute, this passage just explains atonement so well. I should have saved it till then and done something else like then. So just thinking ahead, sketching it out as best as you can, I think is a good way to do it. Another good option, I think, for doing this sort of work is to kind of work your way through the book, but then intersperse that with topical sermons. So you might work through several chapters of Leviticus week by week, but why not do a week on the topic of sacrifice or on the topic of atonement? Kind of starting with Leviticus, the stuff you've been thinking about, but now just step back and consider, well, how does that theme work out across the canon? And then you can step back in and work through another few chapters and then think, oh, let's think about temple. Let's think about how temple functions all the way from the garden as kind of an initial sanctuary where God and people meet together, all the way through to Revelation where a new temple appears and the role of Leviticus in tapping into that. That'd be really interesting. And so you can kind of go backwards and forwards between exegetical or expository sermons and topical sermons. And so if you've never done a topical sermon, you think, I either not convinced you should do that or I don't really know how to do that. There's a great book by Malcolm Gill, Sam Chan, former colleagues of mine, called Topical Preaching. They just walk you through the process. It's with Zondervan. You can find that on Amazon, I'm sure. Really, really helpful for thinking through the process of doing that. But I think a blend can be really helpful in doing some of that. Somebody mentioned yesterday, I can't remember who it was, but kind of Bible project, useful, kind of an overview of a book, whether it's Leviticus or 1 Corinthians. You can watch the video, get a sense of the whole. The Bible project guys have also done lots of biblical themes. And so they can be a useful resource as you work through a given book. So they've got one on sacrifice, they've got one on exile, they've got Staxon, the very talented crew. And so that might be useful. Just 5 or 7 minute long video, teasing out a theme. You can give it to your people to watch during the week coming up to the sermon. So they're already thinking about those ideas. So lots of different ways to try and do this in a given church context. And I think the reward of that sounds like hard work, doesn't it? The rewards are worth it then. I think we all want our people to understand the scriptures better because that's how they understand God better. That's our heart's desire, I think. But there are real tangible rewards for doing this sort of work. Yes, it's hard work. It requires planning, all of that. You get a much richer appreciation, I think, of the Old Testament. And a much richer appreciation of the New Testament. And ultimately, a much richer appreciation of Jesus. I think that's the reward. If we need a carrot, that's the carrot. That's what we want for our people. So they can understand Jesus better and put their faith more wholeheartedly in him. That's what we want. And this is just another way to contribute towards that. And judging by some conversations of the last day or two, you think, okay, some people certainly think, oh, you can just understand the New Testament on its own, you don't need to add in all of that, you can just keep going and do that sort of thing. Okay, sure. There's probably enough residual kind of Old Testament knowledge we can make sense of the New Testament without digging in here. But you can also watch a movie on TV in black and white. And kind of get the gist. It's not a lot better to watch it in color, though, isn't it? I think that's what paying or doing time in books like Leviticus or Numbers or Genesis does. Just turns on the color when you read the New Testament. And we think, well, why don't we give people color and high definition, not just kind of a fuzzy black and white image? But to help us think through some of the potential of that, I'm going to do another talk. But could somebody read the passage for us first? It's maybe mostly a shorter one. Somebody happy to read Leviticus chapter 12, the whole chapter, please. Yep. Somebody happy to read? Matt, great. Yep.
Leviticus 12, NIV. The Lord said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, a woman who becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son will be ceremonially unclean for 7 days, just as she is unclean during her monthly period. On the 8th day, the boy is to be circumcised. Then the woman must wait 33 days to be purified from her bleeding. She must not touch anything sacred or go to the sanctuary until the days of her purification are over. If she gives birth to a daughter, for 2 weeks the woman will be unclean, as during her period. Then she must wait 66 days to be purified from her bleeding. When the days of her purification for a son or daughter are over, she is to bring to the priest at the entrance to the tent of meeting a year-old lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a dove for a sin offering. He shall offer them before the Lord to make atonement for her, and then she will be ceremonially clean from her flow of blood. These are the regulations for the women who gives birth to a boy or a girl. But if she cannot afford a lamb, she is to bring 2 doves or 2 young pigeons, one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering. In this way, the priest will make atonement for her, and she will be clean."
Right, thanks, Matt. Well, I think it's probably fair to say that with Leviticus 12 to 15, we come to probably what's the most neglected part of the most neglected book in the Bible. Because these chapters deal with ritual impurity, a topic that's just seemingly irrelevant from the very start. Forces all the issues we've been talking about. I mean, how many of you have a book on ritual impurity on your Amazon wish list? Maybe not many. Although there are some out there. Rachel Jones just brought out one. It's called A Brief Theology of Periods. So I guess you can decide if you want to buy that for your wife or her birthday. leave it to you to make that decision. But it's good. It's good. Sure. But good. So I may as well express the question that I presume some of you are probably already asking. I mean, we kind of drove or flew all the way to here. Why are we spending the morning talking about this? Surely we can just skip ahead to something more beneficial. Interesting though to think how far ahead you would need to skip. So if you look at your Bible or look at your phone and just flick on a page or two, Leviticus 12 is short, as Matt found out, but the chapters that follow are not short. This is actually quite a substantial part of Leviticus. Even more so if you add in the food laws from chapter 11 and the purification that happens on the Day of Atonement in chapter 16. All in all, that's 27% of the book. A clear indicator, if we needed one, that this topic is actually crucial for life with God. Especially considering that Leviticus has more to say about ritual impurity than it does about sin and forgiveness. But didn't Jesus ignore Israel's ritual purity system, along with temples and priests and all that sort of thing? Well, some people conclude that that's the case. But it really doesn't fit the portrait of Jesus that we find in the Gospels. A Jesus who, for example, in Mark 1, heals a man from the defiling disease mentioned in Leviticus 13, and then sends him to the priest to perform the necessary cleansing. Presumably because Jesus understands ritual impurity to be a real thing that requires the measures that Leviticus stipulates. Maybe thinking, well, it's still very first century, very Jewish. What could be interesting in that? If you look at what Gregory the Great wrote in the 6th century, so here's 6th century Christian church, issues that they're grappling with. Gregory will talk about how it's commendable if a woman decides not to share in communion because she's having her period. And then he says, oh, man does well if he washes after having sex before coming to church. There's a Christian church in the 6th century. You think, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? If you get on a plane and fly pretty much anywhere in the world, you discover that ritual purity still dominates people's thinking. So Bruce Thomas says this, the quote is in your handout for you. He says, perhaps the greatest need felt by Muslim people is not for assurance of salvation, but for deliverance from the tyranny of being in a near constant state of defilement. Unless you think the problem is kind of out there somewhere. Now, as long as I don't leave the fair land of New Zealand, as long as I don't read any church history, I'll be safe and sound. Well, then consider this very real issue that came up for one of my students at college. She was meeting up with a woman from West Africa, reading the Bible with her. They met up one day. And when this woman was invited to turn to a verse in John, she turned to my student and said, oh, can you turn the page for me? I'm having my period. What would you have said next? And would your answer have been biblical? Seems that becoming a more effective witness for Christ here in New Zealand or anywhere really is going to involve understanding ritual impurity. All of which leads us back to Leviticus 12 to 15. There's 157 verses here. I'd enjoy nothing more than spending the rest of the day working through every single one of them. But in lieu of that, I'm going to concentrate on these 8 verses of Leviticus 12, because I think this gives us a window into a world that may well be unfamiliar to us, but I think it helps. So we'll use Leviticus 12 as kind of a gateway into this. And the passage begins with a refrain that's found all the way through the book. The Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, signal from the narrator that all the words that follow come directly from God himself, which is really vital to note here and elsewhere in the book. In the end, Leviticus is so concerned with ritual impurity because God is so concerned with ritual impurity. And in chapter 12, childbirth is the source. A woman who becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son will be impure for 7 days, just as she is impure during her monthly period. On the 8th day, the boy is to be circumcised. And then the woman must wait 33 days to be purified from her bleeding. She must not touch any sacred thing or go to the sanctuary until the days of her purification are over. If she gives birth to a daughter, for 2 weeks the woman will be impure, as during her period. And then she must wait 66 days to be purified from her bleeding. Now, when I'm teaching college students about preaching, one of the things I often say is that if there's a difficult verse in the passage that you're preaching, you can't just ignore and pretend it's not there. Because otherwise, everybody that you're preaching to is just going to be completely distracted by that one verse that you won't talk about. The problem is that every verse in Leviticus 12 is difficult and raises all different sorts of questions. But I think if we pay close attention to the text and work through it, it will give us a really good foundation to work from. And perhaps one thing that we need to clarify right from the very start is that impurity is not just another word for sin. Because otherwise, asking what did the woman do wrong here is to miss the point entirely. Ritual impurity is not a moral problem. Children and safe births are a sign of God's blessing. Nor is ritual impurity kind of a hygiene concern. We don't have here kind of a pamphlet from an ancient Israelite medical practice. Now, ritual impurity describes a status or a state of being that could affect people like here, or places, or objects. And in Leviticus 12, impurity affects every woman who gives birth. That's why there's no command here or anywhere else in these chapters to avoid becoming impure, because you can't avoid becoming impure. And then Leviticus doesn't explain why childbirth makes a new mom impure, just like it won't give any reason for why a certain kind of skin infection makes you impure in the following chapters, or why certain bodily fluids defile, but other ones don't. It doesn't explain any of that. The point of Leviticus 12 to 15 is not to explain, but to quantify sources of ritual impurity and to provide remedial measures. That's the point of the text. It focuses on identification and remedy. They're the two big ticket items here. How do we identify sources of ritual impurity, and how do we remedy them? And so the big questions here, they're in your handout for you. First of all, is the impurity contagious? What are the implications of becoming impure? How long does the impurity last? And how can it be rectified? And already I think that begins to make sense of some of the details that we are given. So again, verse 2, a woman who becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son will be impure for 7 days, during which we're told she'll be impure just as she is during her monthly period. Now, the comparison is not to the same time frame, kind of 7 days and 7 days, because if you look at verse 5, the woman becomes impure for 14 days following the birth of a girl, just as her monthly period. And for that initial time, whether it's 7 or 14 days, the issue is that impurity could be passed on to others. It could be spread, just like it could when a woman was having her period. Impurity in Israel has a social dimension. And I think we understand that far better in a post-COVID world, because COVID restrictions really challenged our kind of sense of individual rights and freedoms, didn't they? Suddenly I became very aware that my actions or my lack of actions had a direct impact on you. And likewise, your action or lack of action had a direct impact on me. And so it was with impurity in ancient Israel. Care was needed to make sure that impurity was not just being transmitted around to everyone. It's all part of loving one's neighbor, looking out for the people that you're living with. But if ritual impurity is not sinful, well then who cares if I'm impure? Who cares if I make you impure? But God cares. Verse 4, for as long as the mother is impure, she must not touch any holy thing or go into the sanctuary until the days of her purification are over. Impurity and holiness must not mix. A little bit like sodium and water. They're both fine on their own, aren't they? A cup of water over here and a lump of sodium over there. Nothing really to see. Put the two of them together. It's disastrous. Just think back to high school chemistry. Maybe that's a story for a lunch. Don't bring them together unless you want a disaster on your hands. Leviticus 15:31, right at the end of this block, makes that point exactly. We mentioned the verse yesterday that says you must keep the Israelites separate from things that make them impure, so they will not die in their impurity for defiling my dwelling place, which is among them. It is not the impurity itself that threatens death. It's defiling God's holy dwelling place that threatens death. And so in Leviticus 12, the mother's impure status meant that she had to avoid going to the tabernacle. She had to avoid sacrificial meat because those things were holy. Which incidentally means that a boy's circumcision on day 8, verse 3 here, happened at home. Not at the tabernacle, not at the temple, because the woman couldn't go there. So presumably that happened at home. But how long did all of this need to go on for? Again, verse 2, a woman who becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son will be impure for 7 days. Then verse 4, the woman must wait 33 days to be purified from her bleeding. So initial week of being impure, followed by 33 days during which she's purified, 40 days in total. So far, so good. But verse 5 complicates things, doesn't it? If she gives birth to a daughter, for 2 weeks the woman will be impure, as during her period. And then she must wait 66 days to be purified from her bleeding. If it's a boy, a 40-day process. If it's a girl, an 80-day process. What does Leviticus have against girls? Well, before we get carried away with that, let's remember the point of the text is to quantify and remedy impurity. It's not to discriminate against women or against their female offspring. And in fact, notice the active agency of the mother all the way throughout the passage. She is the one who's responsible to wait and to not touch and to not go. For her own sake and for the sake of others, she's the one who's required to bring the necessary offerings to the priest. In fact, her temporary exclusion from the tabernacle and from touching holy things tells us that women in Israel could normally go to the tabernacle and touch holy things. Correct, the mother remains an active ritual participant, playing her part in the community of God's people by safeguarding boundaries around holiness. So it's not anti-women. So why then is there a discrepancy between baby boys and baby girls and the impurity that's generated? Well, again, the text is just silent on the matter. It hasn't stopped commentators from being silent on the matter, though. Lots of them have had a go. And you can go and read to your heart's content what people have come up with. I think in my estimation, the most educated guess draws on ancient medical texts, which are almost unanimous in believing that female fetuses developed more slowly in the womb than male fetuses. Almost unanimous across lots of different cultures in the ancient world. Which means that because female fetuses develop more slowly, the idea goes that they use up less blood in the uterus. And so when the baby is more born, there's more residual blood left, and so a greater amount of impurity. Now, that sounds maybe really weird to all of us, but there is a certain logic to it. And it's maybe worth remembering that idea that female fetuses develop more slowly was only disproven scientifically, experimentally, in 1723. So up until that point, there was a fairly standard belief in the world. So I think that's probably the best guess at what's going on. It is hard to know exactly. I think the more important thing to notice, though, is that the mother's impurity is temporary. Whether that's 40 days, whether that's 80 days, in the worldview of Leviticus, the mother is normally pure. She becomes impure following childbirth and for a set time. And so the question then emerges, well, how can she regain her formerly pure status? How does she go back to being pure again? And purification here in Leviticus 12 is a two-step process. First step, we've already seen it in verses 4 and 5, which in Hebrew reads that she must wait in the bloods of her purification. After the initial 7 or 14 days of impurity, the remaining 33 or 66 days function as a process of cleansing, of purification. And so by day 40 or by day 80, the woman has been purified. which makes sense of verse 6, which reads, when the days of her purification for a son or daughter are over, she is to bring to the priest at the entrance to the tent of meeting a year-old lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or dove for a sin offering. So when the mother was impure, she was forbidden from going to the sanctuary. She wasn't allowed to touch any holy thing. But now when the days of her purification are over, she must go to the sanctuary and she must bring a sacrifice. Because that's the second step of purification, presenting a burnt offering and a sin offering. And then you notice that the offering is the same whether it was a boy or a girl, there's no difference. Now, a burnt offering makes sense. We talked about it yesterday. After a rupture in the woman's ability to go to the tabernacle, to partake in sacrificial worship, a burnt offering kind of indicates the woman's ongoing devotion to Yahweh. But what about the sin offering? I mean, I thought childbirth and purity wasn't simple, but it wasn't a moral issue, so why is she bringing a sin offering? Well, here I think we need to remember that sacrifice is a rich and multi-layered concept in which the same kind of offering can achieve different ends. It's a little bit like the giving of flowers in our culture. Sometimes we give flowers to say, I'm sorry. But other times we give flowers just simply to say, I love you. And that might be a good idea for those of you who've left wives at home with young children. Maybe on the ride home from the airport. So we give flowers to say sorry. We give flowers to say, I love you. We also give them a kind of significant moments in life, don't we? Graduation maybe, or a birthday, or different things. So the same act, the one act of giving flowers, has many different potential meanings, depending on context. So too with what the NIV calls the sin offering. When sin is the problem, and forgiveness is what you need, then Leviticus 4 says, do this kind of offering. But when impurity is the problem, and cleansing is what you need, Leviticus 12 says, use this kind of offering. The same offering could be used to address either sin or impurity. Which is why many people suggest that maybe purification offering is an easier term, meaning we get less confused. Now, here's the sacrifice that can purify sin when that's the problem. Here's the sacrifice that can purify impurity when that's the problem. So this woman must go to the tabernacle, bringing a lamb for a burnt offering and a young pigeon or a dove for a purification offering. And then verse 7, the priest shall offer them before the Lord to make atonement for her, and then she will be pure from her flow of blood.
So, just a question. So they shouldn't say sin offering, they should say purification offering.
Happy to talk about that afterwards. Mm-hmm. I think purification just offering makes it less ambiguous for us. Because okay. It makes us ask, what's a purifier? Mm-hmm. Happy to talk afterwards. Good question there. But if the woman couldn't afford a lamb, then verse 8 adds that, well, two birds will suffice. She doesn't have the means for a lamb. We can bring two birds instead. Which is what Mary offers up following the birth of Jesus, which gives us just a little window into kind of what Jesus' family life was like. Not flush with lots of money. So they went for the cheaper of the two offerings. But either way, the result is identical. In verse 8, in this way, the priest will make atonement for her, and she will be pure. And so it's short, 8 verses, but I think Leviticus 12 gives us a really valuable crash course on ritual impurity. See why it mattered, see the dynamics that it has, and I think that helps us as we read the rest of the Bible. And so by way of summary, and again this is in your handout, ritual impurity is naturally occurring, just happens. It's usually unavoidable, you can't do anything to avoid it, no commands to avoid it. It's not sinful. It's temporary, lasts for a certain amount of time, depending on what it is. Sometimes it's contagious, not always, but sometimes it's contagious, you can pass it around. And maybe most importantly, it excludes a person from contact with the holy. Why does God spend so much time talking about ritual impurity in Leviticus? Well, because sin is not the only thing that separates people from his presence. When someone became impure from childbirth or skin disease or a genital discharge, they weren't guilty. They didn't need justification. They didn't need forgiveness. What they did need was God to provide a way to overcome bodily conditions that excluded them from entering holy places. Holiness has more extensive entailments than maybe we realized. Which is why the scriptures will ultimately point forward to the day when God's people will be transformed, not just in spirit, but in body. That's why resurrection is so important. Because we need to be made fit to live in the presence of a holy God, spiritually and physically. And because ritual impurity is just so important, it's really not surprising to see the topic pop up again and again and again, especially in the Gospels. So turn with me to Mark 5. Lots of you are familiar with Mark 5. Lots of you have preached it, maybe multiple times. We're familiar, I think, at least with the contours of the story here. Jesus travels to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, encounters a demon-possessed man, and then afterwards is touched by a woman in the crowd while on the way to heal a sick daughter. We know the story well. You preached it. I know you have. But notice how this whole section of Mark turns on issues of ritual impurity. Look at verses 1 to 20. Story unfolds in the region of the Gerasenes, a Gentile territory on the east side of the lake, and as such, understood as being defiled land in the eyes of at least some in the first century. And there, in that impure place, is a man who lives among the tombs, in constant contact with graves and with bone fragments, making him continually impure. And according to Numbers 19, not only impure, but cut off from God, because he has no one to enact the proper purification for him. In fact, the man is wild. Nobody can get anywhere near him. There's no chance of doing that. Nobody can control him. Instead, day and night among the tombs, he cries out and cuts himself with stones. Because this man was inhabited not just with one impure demon, but with a whole legion of impure demons, who, when Jesus cast them out, possessed 2,000 impure pigs, which charged headlong off a cliff and filled the lake with their defiling carcasses. It'd be really hard to paint a more extreme picture of ritual impurity and the separation from God that it causes than what Mark has done here. But Jesus steps in. And when people returned from the nearby town, they saw the man sitting there, dressed, and in his right mind. And then later, back on the other side of the lake, in the middle of a crowd, a woman reached out her hand to touch Jesus as he passed by. She did that because she had been bleeding uncontrollably for 12 years, making her impure and contagious to others. That didn't mean she couldn't have a relationship with God. But like we all experienced in lockdown, removing kind of the social and communal aspects of worship can be really debilitating. And for her, 12 long years of lockdown, 12 years of not being able to go to the sanctuary, 12 years of not being able to participate in sacrifice or touch holy things, 12 years of needing to be careful around everybody that she encountered. And her desire for a different reality to that is captured in Mark's poignant comment in verse 26, where he notes that she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent everything that she had. But none of it had worked. But Jesus stepped in. And then the news came that Jairus' daughter had died. And now her corpse, like all corpses, would defile not just her parents as they prepared her body for burial, but anyone who even entered the house. Death, the most virulent form of ritual impurity. But Jesus steps in, touches her hand, and raises her to life. Three encounters. Three times Mark highlights the need not for forgiveness, but for purification. But did you notice the really startling difference here? Leviticus 12 quantifies childbirth impurity and provides remedial measures to deal with its effects. Leviticus 13 and 14 does the same for defining skin diseases. Leviticus 15 itemizes the impurity caused by genital discharges and stipulates what you need to do to be purified. Numbers 19 addresses corpse impurity, each passage identifying a particular form of ritual impurity, and then taught Israel how to deal with it, which is a little bit like pointing out a pipe that leaks from time to time, and then showing you where the mop is so you can kind of clean up the mess on the floor when it happens, but never telling you how to fix the pipe, or like sending you off to the pharmacy to get a whole bunch of different things to treat the symptoms you're experiencing, but never actually getting to the underlying disease that's causing the problem. Israel could deal with the effects of impurity, but not with its root causes. But that's what Jesus does. A legion of impure spirits, gone. A defiling genital discharge that had persisted for 12 years, gone. Death, the supreme source of impurity, gone. And whether we understand Jesus as overcoming impurity as the Holy One of God, or whether we think of him taking on the impurity of people just like he will take on their sin, the result is exactly the same. And Mark wants to make the point emphatically. Jesus doesn't simply deal with the effects of impurity. He has power to overcome the very source of impurity itself, which means that Jesus alone and only Jesus is the way to secure permanent access to God and his holy presence. Whoever is united to him, whoever is purified by him, will never be banished again. I mean, isn't that something to add to our doctrine of salvation? Isn't that something to write songs about and sing together, proclaim to the ends of the earth? Jesus, the one who makes us pure, who makes us fit to live with God. And so, surprising as it might be, I think in our commission as Christians to bring the light of Christ to a dark and needy world, whether that's in Hamilton or Hastings, Christchurch or Auckland, Leviticus might actually be essential for the task. Let me pray. Father, we're reminded again of your all-encompassing salvation, which meets all of our needs, removes all the barriers, overcomes all the obstacles. And so we return praise and eternal thanksgiving to you, the God who through your Son fully and finally makes your people pure. Amen. Morning to you in 5, is that right? That's a dangerous thing to say. Let me take... Okay, you can return. You can blame Paul afterwards. What I wanted to just tease out a little bit, kind of following that, is, and kind of connecting into what we talked about earlier, kind of themes and ideas and how to bring those, and the benefit, I hope, of doing that, kind of turning on the color as we come to the New Testament, is just to push into that a little bit. So I put two quotes in here. Let me read them because I think they're worth thinking about. I've put them in your notes so you can go away and think about them again. Just to try and reorient sometimes what we think the relationship between the Old and New Testament is. Now, so these are both from Don Collett, who teaches at Trinity in the States. But he says this, let me read them in full, because I think he says something really important here. The first one says, the Old Testament provides the basic theological grammar for the church's confession on creation, providence, figuration, the nature of biblical inspiration, authorship, Trinity, Christology, soteriology, and ecclesiology. The Old Testament's unique contribution to these doctrines doesn't simply anticipate or duplicate the New Testament's own witness to the same. Rather, the Old Testament renders its witness to these teachings in its own language and on its own terms. These Old Testament terms shape the New Testament's exegetical grammar and theological outlook. That's quite interesting, isn't it? And continues, he says, even after its juxtaposition with the New Testament to form the biblical canon, the Old Testament did not assume secondary status, but remained first-order theological talk, fully capable of providing the church with a place to stand and offer her Christo-Trinitarian claims. In a nutshell, he's saying the Old Testament is not dispensable. It has a unique witness to the person and work of Jesus that we miss if we don't grapple with it. And yes, the New Testament will also testify to the person and work of Jesus, often drawing on Old Testament ideas, but something is lost if we're not bringing our people to the Old Testament and unpacking that for them. And the loss is not just simply kind of, oh, we could understand the New Testament a bit better if we did that. It is that. But it's more than that. There are aspects of Jesus that we just don't fully appreciate unless we sit and listen to the testimony of the Old Testament on its own terms. And so that's why I've been, in our group, we've been kind of thinking, well, I've given them all New Testament passages, but New Testament passages, they kind of force the issue of how do we grapple with the Old Testament background behind that passage, precisely for these sorts of reasons. And so I think preaching canonically, and again, you can tell me if this is the same in New Zealand, so this is the way it is in Australia. I've been listening to Australians give sermons on the Old Testament for the last 15 years, and that's the way it is there, that when people preach the Old Testament, they're very, and I think rightly concerned to preach that passage canonically. I kind of think, okay, we're in Leviticus 12 or we're in Genesis 1 or whatever it is. Let's deal with that text, let's grapple with that, but now we have to kind of expand the context to include not just that, but maybe New Testament particularly and Jesus in particular. How does this connect? Those sorts of questions. That's good and right to do. I see far less concern when people are preaching New Testament passages to preach that canonically. Just 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, that's all we're getting. Just 1 Corinthians 11, that's all it is. These passages are saturated with Old Testament ideas that are vital to understand what Paul is saying or what James is saying or what John is doing. Vital for shaping meaning in that passage, but also the application of that passage. And so, yes, let's preach Old Testament passages canonically. Let's also preach New Testament passages canonically. Because that's the way that we fully grasp what God is trying to reveal about himself. And I would say in that, that I think as preachers, we need to make sure that whether we're in New Testament or Old Testament, we need to make sure that our Christology is sufficiently broad as we do that. So again, back to my own experience of listening to lots of Old Testament sermons that try and get to the New Testament some way. The usual landing point, can you guess what it is? Yeah, the cross. Maybe even penal substitutionary atonement. That's kind of, whatever passage you're in, it all lands in the same place. You just think, that's a really deficient Christology. Of course the cross is important, the cross PSA is important. Not dismissing that. But Jesus is so much more than that. So much bigger than that. The picture is so much richer than that. There are so many different aspects of who Jesus is and what he came to do that we can illustrate and connect to. And often places that are much more natural to connect to rather than kind of forcing this connection. So I've heard lots of Old Testament sermons with exactly the same end. It's like this extended introduction to the same sermon. You think, no, it's so much richer than that, so much better than that. Let me finish and I'll come back to you, Chris. So much better than that. I think we've just got to bring that fuller picture of Jesus. And sometimes it will naturally, very naturally, lead to the cross. Mm-hmm. In consideration of substitution and forgiveness and sacrifice and atonement, go for it. Sometimes it leads to different places. And so here in this passage, Mark 5, or kind of Leviticus 12, Mark 5, or sorry, Leviticus 12 about preaching, you think, well, there's different options here. So I went with Mark 5, because when I originally was preaching this, I was trying to do it as, here's an introduction to ritual impurity. Here's an idea. I'm assuming the people I was talking to had no real idea what was going on. So let's explore that, and let's see the portrait of Jesus that emerges when we understand that a bit more. And so that's why I went to Mark 5. But you could go to Luke 2, couldn't you? So Luke 2, particularly early on, where it says, and the time came, Luke 2, 22, when the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. As it is written in the law of the Lord, every male who first opens the womb will be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. That's like a direct connection with Leviticus 12, isn't it? That's it kind of goes to the Jesus' own family, Mary and Joseph being obedient to the law of Moses, offering the very things that Leviticus 12 talks about at the temple at the end of a 40-day period. And you think, that's a very natural place to go. And yet that raises really intriguing questions, doesn't it? First of all, the Torah obedience of Mary and Joseph, following Torah, being dedicated to that as part of Luke's portrait of this family, which is all the way through Luke chapter 1 as well. So sometimes in class, we're teaching Job a few weeks ago at college, and people are saying, oh, why is Job described as being blameless? How does that work? He said, well, it works in the New Testament too, doesn't it? Like, look at the start of Luke. Like back in 1 verse 5, where it talks about Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth. Verse 6, both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blamelessly. That tells me it's an Old Testament problem. It's a New Testament problem too. What does that mean? But certainly the portrait here of Mary and Joseph is them upholding the law blamelessly, following what Moses said to do. That's interesting. So you could land the same sermon in Leviticus 12 there and tease out some of those ideas. And maybe even in verse 22, that really interesting phrase, when the time came for their purification. Who's that talking about? More than one person. Mary, obviously, that's who needs to go. But who's the other person? Lots of New Testament commentators want to say, ask Joseph. Why do you say it's Joseph? It's unlikely. Is it Jesus? Is this the offering that purifies Mary and Jesus? Can Jesus become impure? Well, there's an interesting count to kick around for a little bit and to think about as a church. And the conception of Jesus. And if your immediate reaction is like, can Jesus become impure? If you want to say, no, of course not. Then what does that actually say about the doctrine of incarnation? I met a Muslim once on the streets of Dublin, and we were talking for a little bit, and then in the end he walked off laughing his head off. He said, "Ah, you Christians believe that Jesus went, or that God went to the toilet." I thought about that, and think, yeah, we do. What does it say about the doctrine of incarnation? Does that mean, what does it mean for Jesus to be incarnated as a Jewish man in the first century? Full incarnation as a Jewish man? Or do you want to limit that? It raises questions, doesn't it? If we want to say, oh yes, of course Jesus became impure just like everybody else, then what does that mean for his role as high priest and offering a sacrifice and entering into the temple? Did Jesus have to purify before he went into the temple, the place he calls his father's house? Interesting questions, aren't they? So pushing us again to consider, who is Jesus? Who do the gospel writers say he is? So lots of options. You could go to 1 Corinthians 15, I kind of hinted at that, the necessity of resurrection. Why does Paul say that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God? Why is he so insistent that when Jesus returns and the final trumpet sounds, that it's not just the dead who will be raised? What happens to those of us left alive? We'll be changed, transformed. Resurrection is not just a means of kind of resuscitation. It's a means of transformation, bodily transformation, to enable people to live in God's holy presence and never run the risk of being banished from that again. That's interesting to tease out. So kind of the one passage here, but there are lots of different ways you could go, none of which in this case kind of directly at least get to the cross, but I think really interesting to tease out our picture of Jesus and who he is and what he came to do and what the New Testament says and how it reacts to all those. And there's lots more too, I'm sure you can think of more. But all of those would be really fruitful. Chris, come back to you now.
Sure. What you're saying resonates with me. I think I was taught to teach the Old Testament like that. I was just interested by your exposition yesterday, which I think felt very fresh because you're doing exactly what you're describing there. I suppose in my mind, I just wanted to ask you about the hermeneutical step that you were taking, because I was struggling to locate Jesus in the text, if that makes sense. Like, were you saying that Jesus is the one who offers, is Jesus the one who offers the perfect sacrifice, or is Jesus the perfect sacrifice, or is there some other way in which Jesus is the, right? I put it like this, that I guess Leviticus 1 creates a type, or some type of type, which Jesus then fulfills in the New Testament. I suppose I was trying to work out what type were you trying to establish, which you then say Jesus fulfills.
Yeah, great question. Yeah, I think it comes down to, again, this. What do we mean by sacrifice? As well as maybe what do we mean by fulfill? I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But what do we mean by sacrifice? The different sacrifices. So I think we're talking about the sin offering in Leviticus 4. And going somewhere, like Tim did yesterday, first in our preaching group, going to somewhere like Romans 3, makes perfect sense. Playing with the same sort of language of sin offering, of bringing forgiveness and right standing with God. I think that's a really valid connection. But Leviticus 1 and the sacrifice there is not doing that. Like I was suggesting yesterday, here is an act of devotion, kind of a physical means of proclaiming your inner devotion to Yahweh. And so I think that the connection to Jesus is just different in that sense. So for Israel, it's, yeah, I do this to proclaim my devotion to Yahweh. But then the example of the woman in Matthew's gospel has exactly the same stance, not with an animal, but with a jar of expensive perfume, but offering that same devotion to Jesus. And so the same, there's a connection there to Jesus that involves him, but it's not as straightforward as that. It just requires a little bit of different thinking. But I think if we're in the sin offering, then we go much more directly with that case. All ones we stop.